time now for World Watchers International with Mae Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Mae.
Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is broadcast number 519, November the 15th, 1981. Next Sunday night will be the 18th anniversary since the assassination of John Kennedy, falling exactly on Sunday evening. And I probably will spend that entire week, that hour of that week, giving as detailed description as I can of who killed John Kennedy and the information that I've based that opinion upon as much as I can put into 1 hour summary on the anniversary of his death. What a series of researchers have compiled and my own individual conclusions that I share with quite a few people around the country, and some of the other researchers haven't gotten to the same place that we are, but they'll get there eventually. We'll do maybe an hour on the anniversary of the death of John Kennedy next week. I did promise you then when Ronald Reagan ran for president and actually won the presidency, it would never be a boring series of experiences. His 8 years as governor in California were just horrendous, and I never could understand why the news people, why the victims of his various behaviors, the causing of prison riots and against the students and the youth movements and the musicians and so many agent provocateur experiences that took place here and breaking the University of California of its entire political activity. There was so much on him for 8 years here, I couldn't figure out why there was so much silence when he was governor of California. But I don't think the other 49 states took him seriously and still thought he was an actor. And all of a sudden, he's president of the United States. And now everywhere, just for the last 9 months, things are coming to a head in Washington. And the infighting among the people themselves is what is really interesting. And I hope to do about a half hour on that this evening. The most marvelous thing is that after building this career for so long and wanting so badly to become president of the United States, he made it. But not only was he shot in March, 3 months after he was president, but all the people that he brought with him, who were all affiliated, as I've said many times, with the past political assassinations or the covering up of those assassinations, he surrounded himself with all those people who have one common denominator between them, and that is a whole era of crimes, of murders, of covering up, of killing political leaders, CIA agents, their own agents, witnesses to trials, and of course, most important, John and Robert Kennedy's murders, and Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X, and many of the great leaders who were heads of governments, such as Allende, and different attempts on Fidel Castro's life. We could do a whole evening on just the coups and the murders, and the attempted murders. But he's surrounded now with a group of people that are forced to be together because they have these things in common, but the irony of it is that they can't stand each other. And so you see a great effort right now to get Richard Allen out, who's National Security Advisor, and he's fighting with Alexander Haig, and we'll talk about that guerrilla in the White House controversy going on, and the new exposés of Mr. Stockman of the Office of Management Budget, Watergating Reagan and bringing that administration down as far as their economic policies go. And then Jack Anderson is pushing again at CIA Director William Casey. They want to get Admiral Bobby Inman in as director of the CIA, just as Admiral Turner was for Jimmy Carter. And they are trying to push Haig even to the brink and remove him because there are other people that the New York Times and Washington Post feel that they can work with better, and particularly those papers, the editorials and the columns are pushing now to get Haig and get Reagan. And I'm sure that the reason for that is to be sympathetic with Bush. You see, Vice President Bush, George Bush, wanted to be president. He was director of the CIA. He's from Yale, even though he's from Texas. He represents the Eastern Seaboard as well as Texas. So he's a perfect blending of the two, the Eastern College with the Texas oil background. And the major council of foreign relations, the trilateral, are basically fighting the Hoover faction, the Reagan factor that have worked together with the Eastern Factor, but they can't personally stand each other. So they're all out gunning at each other, and they're also ganging up. And I want to update you on the Jerry Brown story, trying to push Jerry Brown out, particularly with the Medfly incident. There were several cartoons in the paper this week, but there are a lot of good ones, but one, there were three witches looking over a kettle brewing it, and they, of course, had that typical ugly face that the witches are characterized as having. And one is saying, if we're so clever, how come we're so ugly? And I think I wrote up to the cartoon Haig and Weinberger and Casey and the whole gang in Washington. They were so clever they got there, but they're so horrendous that every country in the world is watching them and turning against us at this time. And there was another cartoon of a news vendor, newspapers and magazines. And on the right hand, he has newspapers that say good news, and then on the left hand, bad news, and you can buy what you want. Well, the good news that I saw this week, the really funny good news that I liked the most was not funny, but Ronald Reagan was forced in the first place to leave the budget cuts right now for a while he settles this fight that's going on. He's too embarrassed. They even use the word embarrassed to push the second budget cuts that he was going to force upon Congress. But also, Ronald Reagan has been forced to pull back on his CIA involvement in the United States, at least for the moment. Now, all of the people that are fighting each other are heavily involved in Operation Chaos during the Nixon administration, in the COINTEL program, in the MKUltra, which was the mind control program. They were all part of CIA involvement in local police departments, such as the Los Angeles Police Department, the New York Red Squad, Philadelphia. They have CIA agents in the police departments, in the schools, illegally in this country. So Reagan was going to make that legal, but temporarily the CIA spying in the U.S. has been put down for the moment. And I think the reason is that the opponents of this sneaky thing that Ronald Reagan is trying to push through will pull more figures and dirt under the rug. They'll pull it out from under him. So right now he's going to slow down on the budget talk. The word was embarrassed right now because of the controversy and exposés of Stockman, and also because all the people surrounding him were involved in all the dirty tricks through this past era, and particularly they got caught at Watergate, and he's going to slow down for the moment. There was a cartoon of Ben Sargent in the newspaper, Austin newspaper, last week. The title was, "How many about your house? How many CIA agents can you find in this American home?" And there's a man looking in the window. They all kind of look like Richard Nixon. There's one behind a lamp. There's one behind Daddy's photograph. Over next to the American flag, there's a microphone hanging. There's one behind the curtain, one looking in the window, one next to the fireplace. It's one of those cartoons where you look for the missing people that you see in children's magazines. How many CIA agents can you find in this American home? Well, the cartoon of the good news and bad news, I guess the good news this week, as I say, is that they're fighting each other, and it forces them to get off our back for a while, at least with domestic CIA or with budget cuts for those who really need it, while they come to some agreement on how they're going to cover all this up. But I don't think there is any way they will. I mentioned last Sunday night on KLRB that Johnny Meyer from the Hughes Organization, formerly with the Hughes Organization, had spoken to me on the telephone and told me that the investigators had offered to drop murder charges on him, murder charges for California. He's going to be brought from Canada if he would release papers on the Howard Hughes Organization and how they were pressuring him. How do you know Mae Bressel? Where do you know her? And he said it was just like an interrogation about our relationship. And I mentioned his asking, did I get my information from Johnny Meyer? He called me Monday morning again, the day after I mentioned this on the air, and he said he got a call from Virginia, from United Press, asking him again about Mae Bressel, and he felt that it wasn't the press at all, but they were pumping him again, and they asked him if he had told me about Paul Schrade being taken by Robert Mayhew and the Howard Hughes Organization to Las Vegas after the killing of Robert Kennedy. Now, he hadn't told me anything about that till we had a conversation, and in the Bill Turner book on the assassination of Robert Kennedy, John Christian wrote with him, it tells about the shooting of, there are many books that tell about the shooting of Paul Schrade. He was wounded in the pantry, and he was standing immediately behind Robert Kennedy. He was a labor leader who was behind Robert Kennedy, and he was shot. And Allard Lowenstein, who was a former member of Congress who was murdered just several years ago when he was working on the Kennedy case, was an attorney for Paul Schrade. He was Paul Schrade's lawyer. And it gives another inkling into the possibility of why Allard Lowenstein was shot at the time the House Select Committee was doing their work, on not on Robert Kennedy's assassination, but on the whole umbrella group of assassins. If Allard Lowenstein was Schrade's attorney, and Schrade was taken to Las Vegas after the shooting and was kept by the Howard Hughes people, then Allard Lowenstein knows more than about Paul Schrade than we know, and that could be a motive for his being murdered. But that was Monday when I talked to Johnny Meyer. He called me, and I left a few hours later to go down to Los Angeles, and I was down there for the week and came back on an airplane Friday evening, 6:30 plane into Monterey, raining and storming. And I was sitting at the airport doing some work and transcribing some notes and got on the plane. And there were a couple in front of me that looked like they were CIA agents, a man with a woman, and they had their attaché cases and very dressed and formal. And other people got on who knew them, and some other knew them. And these people were calling each other by name. And I looked at a man sitting next to me. There was a vacancy between us. And I counted what I thought were about 20 possible CIA agents on this plane. They all knew each other. They were coming up to Pebble Beach for a meeting this weekend, and just a few of them were conversing, and I got that from the conversation. Then when we got off the plane and we were waiting for the luggage in the Monterey Airport, a man was waiting for his luggage, and I looked at him, and I just smiled. It was E. Howard Hunt of Watergate fame, who, of course, has worked with Edwin Wilson and Frank Turpin and the various people that I've talked about on KLRB for many, many years. I had the feeling he knew, probably through photographs, who I was for these 9 years of talking about him and helping Elmer Davis in the lawsuit against E. Howard Hunt that never did go through. He was beaten up, and that's another long story, but I've talked about that before on this program, and maybe we'll get back to it again. And anyway, he waited there at the airport, and I waited, and I realized he was surrounded by an echelon of agents at the highest level of the intelligence. They looked like they came right out of Langley, Virginia. There's something about them, and the way they talked to each other appeared, and he was right in this enclave. And my son didn't believe that was Hunt. I thought that was John Hinckley in front of my house in March, and maybe I'm seeing too many people that I'm studying. So I called the Air California when I got home, and this is a good way you can check sometimes if you have doubts. I called Air California and said that I wanted to reach Mr. Hunt, and I came in on that airplane, and did he come in on that airplane from Los Angeles to Monterey? And they said, what's the name again? And I said, E. Howard Hunt. And I had a list of his aliases in case he didn't travel by that name. And they said, oh, yes, he was booked on that airplane. He came in, he was on there. Do you want us to page him? And I said, no, thank you. I just wanted to make sure he was in town. And it is and was E. Howard Hunt. He may be listening this evening over in Pebble Beach, saying, what are we going to do with Mae Brussel? I don't know. Pebble Beach is an enclave. It's just about 2 miles or 3 miles, the entrance of it, from KLRB station. And there's some very prominent people in the related to the agencies I've been talking about that have homes there. One is the Bechtel family. And, of course, Caspar Weinberger and Schultz, George Schultz, and a long list of people prominent in the Republican Party and currently active, including our Secretary of Defense, are directly linked to the Bechtel Group. And John McCone is head of the Bechtel organization in San Francisco. Now, he was CIA director when John Kennedy was assassinated and has headquarters down here at Pebble Beach. And Justin Dart of the Kitchen Cabinet that put Ronald Reagan into office, and David Packard. And I've been talking a lot about Frank Turpin and getting barely into the Hewlett-Packard connections to Iran and Frank Turpin, Edwin Wilson, and George Kourkoula. Also, I've talked briefly about Marvin Davis, who bought Pebble Beach, the whole area. His friends Frank Sinatra, and on the board of directors is Jerry Ford and Henry Kissinger and Princess Grace. So, and Madame Chanel, the Flying Tiger. So you got a bunch of heavies around here, and I thought it was very interesting to see this plane unload with this gang, and there was E. Howard Hunt. Never saw him before. I don't know. I hope it's friendly circumstances that I see him again, because there's a lot of things coming down in this country, and I can't think of a more important meeting that could take place than this weekend at Pebble Beach. In 1957, there was an Appalachian meeting of the heads of organized crime throughout the United States, which is not separate from the Central Intelligence Agency or the Nazi connections, and that was the year they decided in 57 to literally abduct Howard Hughes and use it as the umbrella for assassination teams for what I call the Nazification of America and divide the pie up between the crime syndicate, and they were directly linked to the CIA and law enforcement and our intelligence operations. That was in 1957, a high-level meeting, and I can't imagine anything more timely with what's going on in Washington now than a meeting at Pebble Beach this weekend, that kind of meeting. And I'm sure when somebody like that comes out from the East Coast, and he doesn't live here, and he's been a part of this whole era, every man that I mention or woman on this broadcast had some finger in the pie with E. Howard Hunt. Edwin Wilson was paymaster at the time of Bay of Pigs with E. Howard Hunt, and of course he worked hand in glove with George Coricola and Frank Turpel of the assassination teams, as did E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis, who worked with Coricola. These people all worked together, and I think it's interesting, as I say, that he's up here this weekend. Now, as these people squabble and fight each other, there is one dangerous thing because they're crazy, and if you attack a crazy animal, unless you know what kind of a beast you're fighting, you have to think of your alternatives, and there are several alternatives Ronald Reagan has, and as governor, he was very much a part of that garden plot, which was to have martial law in the United States. There have been minutes of a meeting where he said if people knew what I was saying, they'd be frightened or they'd hold him on it. This week, he went down to Texas flying in that doomsday plane, they referred to it. They were familiarizing with the plane that they would have if they declared a national emergency, that he would be kept aboard that plane. He drove it in San Antonio to Andrews Air Force Base. He flew around in what I guess was the first time in the doomsday plane. In case we're wiped out, he's up there. Lots of luck. He also reviewed his state of emergency plans. This was in the San Francisco Chronicle this week. He keeps a declaration of emergency that was issued 2 years ago by Jimmy Carter at the time the hostages were taken. But he has an expertise in the emergency plan and the garden plot, and this is part of the action that Ronald Reagan would use if he got closed in too full. I think he would. I was reading part of somebody who subscribes to these tapes sent me one page from a book, American Caesar. It's by William Manchester. It's about General Douglas MacArthur. And there's several references I want to make to that book this evening. But in one of these, it tells about a man that worked very close with MacArthur during the war years. His name was Colonel Richard Sutherland. And his real name, it wasn't Southern, that was the advisor. There was a Robert Eichelberger, who used the code name of Sarah for Sarah Bernhardt, and there was a Colonel Richard Sutherland, and there was another man, a round Eisenhower, called Colonel Charles Willoughby. He was the chief of his intelligence, going back to 1939. Now, 1936 is when Franco started the revolution in Spain and won that revolution. And in from 1936 to 39, until the Germans invaded Poland, 39 was the year they went and invaded Poland, Germans and Nazis were very close to J. Edgar Hoover, to Howard Hughes, to Douglas MacArthur. They worked closely. And he was the intelligence chief in 39 with Douglas MacArthur, this Willoughby, at the time when the Nazis went into Poland, and he was with him in Asia. And his real name, he was a German. He wasn't an American at all. He used the name Charles Willoughby. His real name was Carl Weidenbach, and he had a Teutonic accent like the Kissingers, and he admired Franco. He was a person who admired Franco. And this enclave around Douglas MacArthur wanted a dictatorship in the United States. They wanted to do away with democracy. In 1939, this was before Pearl Harbor, and this book, The American Caesar, goes into the fact of these men surrounding Douglas MacArthur and asking, why don't we have a dictatorship, that the people in America don't know what is right or wrong, that the United States Constitution should be abandoned, we should abolish it, and right then declare a dictatorship, and the dictator may plan the war. And in this book, William Manchester goes on to say that General MacArthur argued against the dictatorship because he says it's okay for the dictator to plan the war. He can get everything worked out to the last detail. He can launch the attack. He does pretty well at the beginning. But eventually, if something goes wrong with the plan or interrupts the schedule, then the dictator isn't flexible enough. So you have to have what you call a democracy to hold it together. Now, that's what happened after Hitler was defeated. These Germans were working with us, and they held together what we call a democracy until they can get back into the war state again. And Douglas MacArthur made the point that the war is an art. He said, when you make war, it's not a science. You can't be sure. It's simply an art. And democracy is there so that you have flexible minds in case something goes wrong. And then you have a democracy and let the war people make their plans. The dictator can call the war, call the shots, and so forth. Now, at the time that Douglas MacArthur was talking about war versus dictatorship in 1939, he had a man with him who later, this goes into martial law, the thinking that Ronald Reagan might pull for a dictatorship to stop this squabbling in the White House and get his absolute powers if he wants them, along with Alexander Haig, who worked with Douglas MacArthur. This same Willoughby, who actually was a German, Karl Wiedenbach, the chief of intelligence for our army, who was actually a German, was the man who worked with the government, letting the Japanese off from those experiments that I talked about last week or the week before. The same man that was working with Franco, sympathetic to Franco, is the same man who gave the go-ahead on hiding the secrets of experimenting on American soldiers. Here's a Teutonic person, German accent, German name, changes himself to Charles so that it would be more sympathetic. And he's the identical person whose name was in that long document on the experimentation of American soldiers by the Japanese and letting them off the hook. I got a complete report of the October 1981 Bulletin of Atomic Scientists on Japanese biological warfare from 1930 to 1945. And when Japan and Germany were fighting the United States and Japan was experimenting on American soldiers, this same Willoughby was the advisor to Douglas MacArthur in the Pacific, allegedly fighting the Japanese. And he is the person named in this document by John Powell, who at the time the war was over, it was Mr. Willoughby who said, keep it a secret, and there's memos here on how he wanted to keep the experimentation secret and use the advantage. Now, the Nazis were doing experimentations in Germany, and the Japanese were doing them to Americans, not Japanese or Europeans. In the difference is that Nazi Germany pulled in from all the different countries and experimented on those people. But the Japanese were using American soldiers for experimentation. And this same Willoughby approved of these guinea pigs and American soldiers, and he was working on the staff of MacArthur. This full report on the experimentation says, on December the 12th, 1947, a report was made by Dr. Edwin Hill, chief of basic science at Camp Dietrich, Maryland. And that, of course, is where Richard Helms and E. Howard Hunt come into these things. Pretty soon, E. Howard Hunt will be in the CIA. They acknowledge the wholehearted cooperation of Brigadier General Charles Willoughby, MacArthur's intelligence chief. And Dr. Hill wrote that the objectives to attain the material and the reports from the Japanese to examine human pathological material was fine and that they would cover them up. Now, this report by John Powell, that's in the Bulletin of Atomic Science, talks about Mr. Willoughby and refers to him by name as General Charles A. Willoughby, MacArthur's intelligence chief. But what this John Powell might not know is that this is a man similar to Licio Gelli, who adored Franco, who worked with Hitler and Mussolini, who fled Italy recently as part of a worldwide Nazi fascist organization. This same Charles Willoughby that approved of Americans being chopped up was a German whose real name was not Willoughby, it was Karl Wiedenbach, and he worked as the head of intelligence for Douglas MacArthur in the Pacific. So that's a little addition to that story of what is going on the subterfuge. This problem of America being sold out, American GIs being sold out, it goes way, way back to the end of World War One, and Nazis and fascists from Japan and Germany were taking over, obviously, our chief of staffs and directing them all the time, and that's why we're on the brink of World War III today. Now, Ronald Reagan can use those emergency powers. He can fly around in the doomsday buggy if he wants, that airplane. This week, last week, you saw John J. McCloy testifying that the internment of Japanese before was humane. He was former Assistant Secretary of War at the time. He believes it was good for them to be relocated. John J. McCloy was former chairman of Chase Manhattan. He was on the Warren Commission. He would approve of concentration camps again to round us all up. And last week I talked about that. This week the White House is warning 183 draft evaders. They'll start with them and begin to see why they didn't register. Now, the Haitian Cubans are being shipped upstate New York to an icy climate, not the one I described last week, and that camp is still open, and I imagine that it will receive those people who oppose the war if they decide on the garden plot, the martial law plan that Reagan could pull. That would be his out. If he doesn't use that out and declare war and have some kind of a agent provocateur incident that gives him total powers, then this whole corrupt administration could just fall flat on its face. Last week, we updated a little bit about Frank Turpel and George Corcoran and their appearance on 60 Minutes. And if any of you saw it this evening, they updated that report for you. And it's been in the newspapers all week. The two gentlemen are missing. They allegedly have been kidnapped by three Syrians. There's a rumor, according to 60 Minutes this evening, that foul play was suspected and possibly Edwin Wilson was involved. Edwin Wilson worked closely with Admiral Bobby Inman, who's now deputy director of the CIA, who would be CIA director if Casey is out. And he's being pecked away, as I said before. These men might get that treatment that many of the other agents got, such as Dorothy Hutt or William Harvey or William Sullivan of the FBI. The CIA, the Defense Department, will murder anytime it's convenient, such as John Paisley, Frank Nugent, any of their agents. The agent's life isn't worth a wooden nickel. They can be just killed on the spot. Now, these men were very honest in 60 Minutes. In fact, I mentioned and admired their outright honesty. They were asked, where's your morality? And they had a remark about morality, that torture is taught by the United States. And to confirm what they said, there was an article this week in the Washington Post, U.S. books on torture reported. A former member of Uruguay, a Navy intelligence officer, left there. He was trained with the United States printed books on torture in Montevideo, and the men who do the torturing are trained in American camps in Panama. And he says the textbook talks about physical torture, psychological torture. There are various ways. One's called submarine, putting head in water and hanging them on ropes and dropping their head back and forth. The other is the electrical shocks. And the United States government prints manuals of 35 critical nerve joints on the body where electrodes would be applied. And the third method is the hot water, where you put towels of hot water over their head and keep putting more hot water and more hot water. Those are American printed textbooks. And what I liked about the program was that when they asked were they moral or immoral, or was Idi Amin moral or immoral, they said it's done with American equipment, American technology. It's taught by you, and we're paid to do it. We're taught how to do it. And just an article came out this week of somebody who escaped from Latin America and is exposing it. Well, the men are missing. I don't know if they're killed. That will be a very major change in the behavior of some of these agents. Maybe that's what the high-level meeting is at Pebble Beach this weekend. Edwin Wilson has been part of an assassination killing team for years, and he offered to bring in two Chileans that had a part in killing Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C., and Rennie Moffitt in exchange for his immunity. And he asked, you know, what would I get if I came to the United States? He offered several heads as is. And I believe that he was over there probably to deliver Gaddafi and Arafat, and then they'll let him off the hook as a big hero. There's a rumor, according to a friend heard the broadcast, the last part of 60 Minutes. Somebody had called me, I missed it, and there was a rumor that Edwin Wilson was involved in this, but he isn't speaking. This is a treacherous game, this espionage game, but the worst part is they do it to each other, and they get us on the brink of World War III, and it's a mess. Washington is a mess. We'll take a one-minute break and get back to some more of the problems in Washington in 1 minute.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with a second.